Last lecture, what we were doing was thinking about various experiments we could do to detect curvature. And at the end of the lecture, we ran into this object called the Riemann curvature tensor. And so it was something that I wrote with an R and four indices, and there was a big long formula that involved derivatives of the Christoffel symbol and also products of Christoffel symbols with various indices contracted in different ways. And I just wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about that object. So the key thing was that it is a tensor. So it's something that transforms nicely under coordinate transformations, but it's something then that describes the curvature in a nice way. Remember, before we had had a discussion about doing coordinate transformations at a point, and what we said was that at any given point I could make the metric trivial, and I could in fact meaning that it would look like the metric on Minkowski space. And I could also get rid of first derivatives of the metric, but I couldn't get rid of second derivatives of the metric. And but a second derivative of the metric by itself wasn't a nice object. And so this is a nice object. It has nice coordinate transformation properties. And implicitly here, it is packaging or describing or contains second derivatives of the metric. So that was as expected. In principle, though, we might have counted four indices here. Those four indices can each take four values. And so in principle, this contains, or that package contains 4 to the 4th, or 256 numbers. On the other hand, if we remember our counting when we were talking about curvature, and the second derivatives, what we said is we could get rid of all but 20. And so this seems to be an overcounting, or it seems to be too much information here to really describe what we thought of as curvature in this first pass up here. However, there are a number of symmetries or identities that this satisfies. And so one way to identify those symmetries or those identities is to stare at this complicated formula and meditate for a long time. We identified one symmetry, namely an anti-symmetry in these last two indices. But there's a trick to finding the complete set of symmetries more quickly. And so and that is to use this coordinate transformation that we talked about before. So we'll pick a point. At that point, we'll find a coordinate transformation where the metric is the flat space-time metric, and the first derivatives vanish. What that means is that these quadratic terms involving the Christoffel symbol, those all vanish. But the second derivatives are non-vanishing, and so this piece or that contribution we can't get rid of. But in that coordinate system, then this formula simplifies. So So at a point, we choose and so these were the free fall or inertial observer's coordinates. And so this implies that gamma is equal to zero, or gamma with all the indices. But it doesn't imply second derivatives of g is vanish, or that first derivatives then of gamma vanish. But this formula reduces down to minus del nu alpha beta mu. So we only have those two terms. To make things more symmetric, or to make the symmetries or the identities more obvious, though, what we do is we also lower this index. Right now we have three covariant indices and one contravariant, or one upstairs index. So we form G alpha beta mu nu equals G. So we just contract with the metric. And so I would contract this formula with the metric. And then what I would do is I would expand. But again, and so I would explicitly insert the formulas here for what the Christoffel symbol is. And then I would expand everything, but I would remember that I'm in a coordinate system where first derivatives vanish. And so you end up with a very, or a much simpler formula, which has, well, there are lots of indices, there are four contributions, but these identities will become more obvious. So this is an identity that you may have looked at last night, or a formula. And then minus del beta del mu. So again, what I've done is I've inserted the formula for the Christoffel symbol. I've got that as well, but I keep that in mind. And what I get is just four contributions, each one of them being a second derivative of the metric. And now, for example, the identity that we talked about last day again, well, it was it was obvious already last day, but what we commented on was that if I switch the last two indices, I pick up a minus sign. And I can just see if I'm trading mu and nu here. So for example, that trades these first two terms, but the cost is a minus sign. And again, I'm trading mu and nu in the last two terms, and again, the cost is a minus sign. So I would have this to be true using that formula. And so this is a statement that's true at that point in this coordinate system. But then this is a tensor equation, and so I know that this should be true in any coordinate system. But it should also be true at any point, because I can do this exercise at any point. And so even though this formula that I'm using, which I'm using for its simplicity, is only applying in a particular coordinate system at a particular point, The conclusion I draw when I write it like this is something that must be true everywhere in all coordinate systems. There should be a minus sign. Sorry. Okay, so this conclusion, tensor equation, so all I've done now is I've recovered what we saw last day anyway. But if we stare at it, or if we stare at this formula, there are some other interchanges that become obvious. One is if I interchange not the last two indices, but the first two indices, so I'm trading alpha and beta, then I would be trading this term with this term. And again, the cost is a minus sign. And similarly, I trade this term, and the cost is a minus sign. And so we also have minus r beta alpha mu nu. Another symmetry. Well, I could take this equation and I could raise alpha over here, but then I'd be doing the same thing here. I'd be raising alpha. So there is an equation with indices raised. It's just, yeah, so I think the answer is yes. No problem. Another identity that's obvious is, or should be obvious, is if I trade alpha and beta for mu and nu. So I'm going to trade. So I'm going to go from this to mu nu alpha beta. So I'm trading an alpha into the mu slot and a beta into the nu slot. And so basically that is trading. So alpha goes into the mu slot. Beta goes into the new slot. And if you take into account that the metric is symmetric in indices, and these ordinary derivatives are symmetric, or it can be applied with any order, I'm just trading the first two terms here, and so there's no sign. And I'm also trading the last two terms, and there's no difference of sign. And so that one comes in with a plus. Another slightly more complicated one, but it's most easily identified there, is a cyclic identity. So in this case, what I'm doing is I'm going to take my alpha, beta, mu, nu, and then add to it copies of the same object, but I'm going to cycle these three indices through each of the slots. So beta mu alpha nu, mu alpha beta nu equals 0. So again, all I've done is I've traded the labels on the first three indices in those three terms. I'm adding them together, and the claim is that what you find is that the sum is always 0. And so what this is saying is that even though in principle there are 256 components, for this curvature tensor, they satisfy a number of algebraic identities. And so they're not all independent. And in fact, given those identities, the claim is that I can, the number of independent components is reduced down to 20. And this matches the counting that we did many lectures ago when we were just asking about how many of the second derivatives of G can I get rid of just by doing coordinate transformations. And the idea was that we get a lot. Well, there were a lot of them that we could get rid of, but we would always, there weren't enough degrees of freedom to eliminate all of them. There were 20 left over. There's one other important identity that we're going to put on hold for the moment, but I'll just allude to it. So we have the Bianchi identity, or a Bianchi identities, involving derivatives. Derivatives of R. But we'll have to talk a little bit more about how to take the derivatives properly. So we'll I'll just pause there. Is everybody happy with that? Okay. If so, I was going to return to our experiments, but I find I have to do a little bit of more math. And so I wanted to talk about bases and dual bases again, just to introduce some notation and some ideas. So. So remember that we talked about, we have, typically we're using a set of coordinate basis vectors. And so there are some basis vectors that we can explicitly write out, or that we attribute to that symbol. And so any vector I have, I can expand like this. But there was also useful to introduce the idea of a dual basis. Which my notation from a while ago was that rather than putting underscore tilde, what I did is I put hats on it. I think in the book they're all just called boldface. And the key property of our dual basis was that there was going to be some kind of inner product or mapping that when I combine one of these with one of those, I get just a Kronecker delta. So so a notation that the book introduces in chapter 20 is something like that. And so remember, these were what we called vectors. This dual object, or the dual basis, is a basis of one forms or covectors. And so I would expand my one forms in that basis. Those were the objects with downstairs indices. And so I would, this kind of an expansion applies here as well. Using that symbol, or it's not long before they start writing this as well, just as an ordinary interproduct. Yeah.
The hat. The hat on top of E.
This was, yeah, this was, so the underscore tilde was to describe a vector. So when we expand vectors, those are objects that have this upstairs index all the time. When I'm talking, but we also talked about objects that had downstairs vector or downstairs indices, and there's another set of, there's a set of basis vectors or covectors that I can use to expand any one form. Well, at the, you could. So that's an equally good notation. This is just to emphasize on the board where my where the typesetting is already not so great. This is just to emphasize that these objects are different than those objects. These are one forms. Those are vectors. Well, no, the idea is that this is a certain kind of object. It is a vector. What we said, though, was that it's easy to build the one forms given a set of vectors and a metric in that we can use the metric to relate the vectors or the four vectors and covectors or one forms. Just so I would write G alpha beta V beta. So written as that, this collection of objects transforms in one way under the coordinate transformations. But if you combine that with how the metric transforms, you find that in essentially this transforms in the inverse way. And the key idea was that this allowed us, or this Kronecker delta then gave us the invariant products. You know, this contraction was then an invariant under the coordinate transformations. So that was, well, that was all things we had talked about. The new idea was something that I was skirting around last day, had to do with the orthonormal bases. So there we also had a set of basis vectors, and we gave them a different set of labels. So rather than writing, you know, T, X, Y, Z, here we might have written T hat or just 0, 1, 2, 3. But this was to distinguish that A, just like this alpha is distinguishing different basis vectors. And the key here was that this interproduct, or these were normalized to be orthogonal and to have unit norm. And so when we took that set of interproducts, what came out looked like the 8AB of the Minkowski space. And we also had No, I'll skip that. Okay. So the idea is that we can also come up with a dual basis for these vectors, or for and so again, I'm going to write a bunch of symbols. They're now one forms. They carry a set of four indices, although now instead of alphas and betas, I'm going to write A's and B's. And to make sure that we know that they're one forms, I'm going to put hats on them. And it's convenient now to put the label upstairs, just like the label here is upstairs. And the defining property here was that E hat A, E tilde B was going to give me a delta AB. So that's the analog of this formula here. Just as vectors were expanded there and covectors or one forms were expanded, we can expand them in the new bases. But then really the thing that I danced around last day is how do I pick out these components, the expression for the components of the vector in a particular basis. And so I did that last day by taking, we only had the basis vectors around, and so I did an inner product, and that wasn't quite right. It's much cleaner now, though, to say that what I can do here is I can pick off VA by simply taking the inner product with the covector, or the set of covectors. Like this. So this is then E hat A dotted with E tilde B, VB, but this is just a delta AB, VB, and so that's VA. So that's just saying then that it's handy to have these guys around because it just cleanly lets me pick off the various components here because what these are the projections of the vector on the various basis vectors, but then this nice relation tells us how to pick off each one of those components or each one of those projections. And of course, I can do the same thing here. Although this is a set of one forms, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take an inner product with a basis vector. So I have an S hat dotted with an E tilde A. And it's a simple exercise to go through the same set of exercises or the same set of manipulations, and you end up with a delta AB that gives you just one of the components there. So, are we all happy with that? That was simple enough. Now, what we ended up with last day, though, was a formula which you may or may not have noticed had both, well, components of a vector in the orthogonal basis and various components of vectors in the coordinate basis. And so what we'd like to know is, well, how do you convert back and forth between those? And, well, it's relatively straightforward. We had, we talked already about the fact that these are, that's just, if I take any one of those, it's just a vector, and so I can expand it in this basis. So we wrote this as EA alpha. So that set of coefficients, or that matrix, is something that helps us convert between one basis and the other. And in particular, then, say I had my V alpha equals E alpha.
I'm just trying to understand that equation you've written there.
So this is, let's set this equals 0 hat. That's a vector. I can expand it in the coordinate basis.
You're using Roman subscripts to indicate where the normal basis and Greek to
coordinate. And so I can, this is just saying that I can, well, I can expand one set of basis vectors in terms of the other set of basis vectors. And so we had originally written it like this. We can also write the same vector like this. Or that formula says that I can write that. And so this then is a formula that converts, or what it's saying is that this set of indices, or that matrix, converts us from components in one basis to components in another basis. And there's a similar set, well, in the same way that I can trade the vectors, I can trade the covectors or the one forms. And so I can do that. I could write a similar formula for trading between components of one forms, and I'd use this set of indices here. An interesting question, though, is how do I go the other way? How do I, given this set of V alphas, how do I turn that into a set of VAs? But we had this handy formula here that said what I'm supposed to do is I'm just supposed to project with our dual basis vector. So VA is equal to EA hat dotted with our V tilde, which is equal to V alpha. If I just expand this guy, then this is EA hat dotted with E alpha tilde. I don't yet have a formula for that, but what I can do is I can just use this formula here. So this was just, because I know the inner product in the coordinate basis, I was just expanding this one form in that coordinate basis. And so I've introduced that second matrix, or that second set of components there. But this then was just a delta beta alpha. If I stick that in there, what I find is then that's EA beta and so I see that going the other way, precisely what enters the formula is this set or this expansion, this set of, or that matrix, which is giving me the expansion of that one form in the coordinate basis, or those one forms. So does that make sense, or are we happy with that? Not terribly unhappy with that. Yeah. Sorry?
With the picture, or I mean, I just kind of see what you're doing, but just the notation is kind of impenetrable.
Sorry, setting.
Is there any benefit of using different notation on the board?
Is there any benefit of using different notation on the board? I don't know how to do a boldface on the board.
No, I mean, for one form, they just use under, like, a total letter and that. That's very clear.
Now, I'm pretty sure in the book, everything's just a boldface, and you have to. The only thing that distinguishes it is that what was said before is whether the indices are upstairs or downstairs.
Well, I don't understand this data about the form factor rather than about the index.
Oh, you mean, okay, so you mean rather than Roman and trading between Roman and Greek? So what they're doing, or what he's doing, is he's saying,
isn't it the case that when the index is up, this is already a one-form?
To answer the first thing, when he's writing things like this, as opposed to that, all he's saying is, well, yeah, no, he's indicating that that's in the an orthonormal basis, and this is in a coordinate basis. And, well, okay, so you're saying that I should write that. It's conventional. Well, okay, if you're happier with that, you can translate all the formulas. Rather than writing A's and B's, you can write alpha hats and beta hats. What you'll find in the literature, though, is it's conventional to trade between the labels in that way. But what, okay, if that's a point of confusion, everywhere I'm writing the A's or the orthonormal, the things that label the orthonormal basis, in the book, it's true that when he evaluates this, when he says, let's pick a component, what he does is he writes a particular coordinate direction and puts a hat over it.
No, it looks like I don't understand this, the notation for the one forms. Because why are we not using just E underlined index and upper index, and that would already be one form, no?
Yeah, no, I agree. So in the book, he wrote boldface, and then indices are upstairs or indices are downstairs, and all. Okay, if that's a point. Okay, I thought this was simplifying things. If it's confusing, then I apologize. But this is just to emphasize that this collection of objects is different than that collection of objects. That these are basis one forms as opposed to basis vectors. But that's just, I thought it made the, what I was writing on the board simpler, but if it's confusing you, then just copy it down differently. Yeah.
Well, I just frankly wanted to say I actually prefer this because it's easier to tell when you've got when you're referring to an entire vector or one form rather than a particular index.
Right.
Because otherwise the H1 vector would be easy to confuse with the
behave component of.
Well, okay, that's just notation. So you wanted a picture, though.
I'm just trying to figure out where you're going with this, because, I'm mostly trying to just visualize what you're doing, because I guess you want to convert between these two bases, right? So,
Right, so if I pick a point in the space-time,
okay.
When I talk about orthonormal bases, I'm putting a very special restriction on it. And I'm saying I've got a set of basis vectors, but they're always unit vectors, and they're always orthogonal. So this is a whatever. But that of course isn't unique. There are lots of basis vectors like that. In fact, if this is Minkowski space, I can do all sorts of boosts. So even if I'm just in two dimensions, I can do boosts. And, you know, this set of vectors, so I better start labeling them.
Is this different from what we did before?
No.
Okay.
No. This is the only new formula. Or this is a formula that was implicit. This is a new formula. Everything else is the same. The only difference, then, is that the coordinate bases are adapted to some coordinate system that runs through that point, which, you know, may not have any particular nice properties at that point. And so those basis vectors, although, you know, very convenient because they're adapted to the coordinates, you know, they don't have to have unit norm, they don't have to be orthogonal. And in fact, you know, that's their inner product is giving you the G alpha beta. And so there's nothing magical about it. It's just that it's useful to have formulas to go between the two. And in particular, implicitly, or actually very explicitly, I wrote formulas on the board last day where I had components of n in the orthonormal basis, and I had components of n in the coordinate basis. And that's kind of mixed up, and so I just wanted to fix that and be able to write you know, all of the components in the same basis. And that's really why I'm doing it. So it's just, so there's a lot of formulas there. It's just that the bottom line is that I can go between the two bases very easily. But really what you needed to know about, or the thing that we hadn't introduced before, was the idea that the orthonormal vectors also had, you know, I could construct a dual set of one forms for those. So that was really the only new idea, and that lets us write formulas like this too.
Okay.
Okay. So let's go back to the experiments that we were talking about last day. So this is some new notation. Again, this is the important thing that we can convert between our two kinds of components, or between our two bases, using these sets of matrices, or these things that appear here. So recall the experiments we talked about. And so what we were talking about was detecting the effect of gravity or inhomogeneities in the gravitational field by following two nearby particles. And we did it first for Newtonian gravity. And what we came up with was a formula that told us how the separation between these two nearby particles varied. And what it did is it felt the second derivatives, or the tidal forces, in the gravitational potential. And I should put an approximately, what we were thinking at a certain point was that n was small and we were doing a Taylor expansion. And so we had a linear equation. In principle, there are higher order corrections, but those go away as n shrinks. And so these were indicative, or that matrix of derivatives was indicative of what we call the tidal forces. Those are just the forces that are pushing or pulling the particles further apart, or pushing them closer together. But the other thing that we noticed was that that same matrix, or that same set of derivatives, also played a role in the equation for the gravitational field. In particular, what we did in writing the field equation was that we took the trace of this matrix and we set it equal to our matter sources. So in the absence of matter, we were just solving Laplacian phi equals 0. Now, the discussion was a little bit more elaborate for a curved space-time. Or what we came up with was called the equation of geodesic deviation. And there's a picture. Now the we don't have an absolute time. The parameter that we're parameterizing things in is the proper time along our reference geodesic. There's a four velocity that tells us where that geodesic is going. There's also, again, for this nearby or displaced geodesic, there's a four vector that tells us where the nearby particle is going. And what we arrived at was a formula that took the form d2 na d tau squared equals minus, and then our curvature tensor, and so this is where we first we went through a long, detailed calculation, and we came up with a complicated expression that we bundled up, and that's where we ran into the curvature.
What is the index of E?
So this is an E, it's got a downstairs A, and it's got a downstairs beta. And then this is an N, and it's got an upstairs alpha. But, okay. Well, it may bother you that this object doesn't appear here quite, and it doesn't appear here quite. And that's because we were fooling around last day, and I introduced this extra A to AB into the calculation or into the discussion, because we didn't have these covectors around. I only had those objects to play with. And so implicitly, what's happening is there's an A to AB hidden here that's lowering this index. So it's this object, but we've lowered the index. If you allow me, I can fix that, and I can just raise it with an A to AB again. But that means that I'd better raise that index so that everything's consistent. I mean, another nice thing about these set of formulas is that the raised and lowered indices, those rules are all consistent now because we have these basis one forms. Before, we weren't quite sure. Sometimes we ended up writing formulas where the orthonormal indices were raised when it looked like they were lowered on the other side of the equation. But in this notation, everybody, well, we apply the same rules as before. If it's raised on one side of the equation, it had better be raised on the other. And we can lower and raise it with the A to AB, which is what we were doing last day. Chris, did you have a question? Or
just wanted to ask if it's
okay. So this is now a set of coefficients that we recognize. It's precisely that set of coefficients there. And so this formula almost looks like the formula up there. It basically has the same form. I've got a second derivative of an n, and I've got an n over here. And so there's some, I can think of this object as some matrix that converts the index on the I to the j on the n. Or here it's an alpha, and here it's an a. And so this is that embarrassing moment where I see, well, you know, the n over here is in coordinate, has a coordinate index. And over here, because we were talking about a measurement, I made sure to put an orthonormal index on it. And so the whole point of that exercise was to assure you that there's a simple procedure by which I can convert these indices back and forth. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to convert that into the orthonormal index. So better use a different letter. So I'd like to apply that formula here. And then what I'm going to end up with is a formula that has the basic structure just like there's a minus sign here. I'll stick a minus sign there. There's some matrix. It's got indices on it. And there's an n there. And what is that matrix? Well, it is this curvature tensor. It's contracted with two of these u's, or four vectors, four velocities. And it's contracted with a pair of these sets of indices. So there's an EB alpha, but there was also an EA beta over here. And then we better fill in all of the indices. Or alternatively, if we don't mind mixing indices on the curvature tensor, basically what this is doing these objects are projecting these indices into the orthonormal frame. And so I can compactify the formula slightly by writing this as an A gamma B delta. Where when I see an index like that, what I mean is that, well, I can convert it back using one of these or vice versa. So that's just a slightly more compact way to write the same thing. But what we'd really like to do is we'd like to take the lead or the hint that Einstein or that the Newtonian gravity was telling us, which was that this is now in the context of our curved space-time telling us about tidal forces. And the equation of motion, though, in the Newtonian gravity just came from taking the trace of that matrix. And so I'd like to do the same thing here and suggest that that's a useful way, or that that's a proposal for the Einstein equation, or what should appear in the Einstein equation. Now, on this side of the equation, though, we have the matter sources. And what I said was that we weren't quite sure how to deal with the matter sources yet. That'll be a discussion for next day. And so what I'll think about just is Einstein's equations in a vacuum or in the absence of any matter sources. So I'm thinking of setting a zero there. And so the proposal is, that Ka, Ka just be equal to zero. And so I'll pause there and I'll ask, what's wrong with that equation? Or is that a good idea? Is that a good equation that we should be using? Bruno.
It doesn't give enough equations to determine the metric, which has 10 components.
So what we were talking about before was that, you know, we had a metric. We had a tensor's worth of things we're solving for. We should have a tensor's worth of equations. And this doesn't seem to do that. Another objection you might have is that, well, I didn't write it out yet, but it refers to the four velocity of a particular geodesic. But that's actually what's going to save us, because I want this equation, or this equation is true quite generally. I didn't specify, or I didn't say there was anything special about the reference geodesic. And so it should apply for any geodesic, i.e. it should apply for any four velocity that I want to plug in there. And so in fact, what should be true is that this equation, when I strip it of those two contractions, should also be true quite generally. So let's see if we can write that out. So first of all, what is that equation? So we had Ka, Ka equals zero. So there was an Ra gamma A delta. Now again, this is a contraction. It's an invariant contraction. It's projected. It happens to be projected into the orthonormal bases. To make the equation prettier, I can also write it as alpha gamma alpha delta. So now I'm just writing everything in terms of coordinate indices. And this contraction actually has a name, and we assign it a new label, which is the same R with just two indices. So this is called the Ricci tensor or the Ricci curvature. But now, what the discussion there was is that this refers to a particular reference geodesic if I'm setting it to zero, but I would want it to be true independent of that choice. And so the natural thing to do is to set actually, well, this should just be an auxiliary set of numbers. What the real equation should refer to is the vanishing of the Ricci tensor. So this is Einstein's equations in the vacuum. One thing that we can check is this object is the tensor. That's good. It has it's going to have the right or nice transformation properties. In principle, it's got two indices, and so that counting looks appropriate. Because we're looking to solve for a two-index object. However, the metric is actually a symmetric tensor. And so we expect then that this had better be a symmetric tensor. But that's easy to verify. So what this was a contraction of the first and the third index. So basically, what I can do is take my Riemann and just contract those two indices with a metric. But I know, or an identity that we saw at the beginning of the lecture, was that there was a symmetry in interchanging the pairs of indices here. So that was an identity where there was the plus sign. But similarly, then, I can interchange the indices there. Let's write it out. So this is G lambda gamma. And if we're going to be very explicit, these are just dummy indices. And so I can rename gamma lambda, and I can rename lambda gamma. And so what we've shown is that, in fact, this tensor is a symmetric tensor. And so it has the right properties, it seems. or this as a collection of equations has the right properties to solve then for the metric. So sorry, say that again? Right.
And so, show that this equation works. You just used a metric. And so, how do you get that metric without having solved for it first?
No, but these, okay, this object is just something, I mean, the only thing I know about that object is some equation that I wrote down, which involved the metric and derivatives of the metric. And so when I write that on the board, I'm just being lazy and I'm not writing out that complicated expression in terms of metrics. But implicitly, this is a general functional of G, you know, derivatives of G and second derivatives of G. And so that's some, you know, this is some complicated differential equation involving G. And so, the properties that I used here don't refer to any specific solution, just the general structure of this object and that object. But one of the things it points to is that this, I mean, Newton gave us something similar, you know, but this was a nice linear equation. This is a horrendously nonlinear equation, and so it's much harder to work with in general. Which is why in the tutorial, what you're going to do is, in principle, you can work with this with pencil and paper. We have all the appropriate formulas, but you know, as someone who works with this equation all the time, I never use those formulas. I can just, you know, somebody wrote computer programs to do or to make those calculations very simple, and the computer doesn't make as many mistakes as I do. So it's much better practice when you're doing these calculations to do them on the computer. Although it is good practice if you're going into this field to do a couple of calculations by hand, just so you can feel that you've suffered and you know, or that you're familiar with what's really hidden here. So that was a bit of physics. Here's our marvelous proposal for the vacuum Einstein equations. But now, unless there are any questions, I want to go back and do a little bit more math. One of the reasons being is because this discussion, or the counting that's implicit here, i.e. 10 equations for 10 components of the metric, is a little bit naive. And in fact, there's another identity, again, that I alluded to that's going to play an important role, namely this differential identity. But we have to think about how we act with derivatives, or how, what are useful derivatives to be working with in curved space-time. So can I go on to that? Okay. So what did we do? So in our experiments, we were thinking about comparing nearby geodesics. But implicitly, we were comparing nearby, or the evolution of nearby vectors. And so what we like to do is like to come up with some useful rules on how to take derivatives of metrics or how to compare vectors at nearby points. So for what last day's discussion. And so in particular, we may have written something like that we had V alpha of x, but then we also want to think about x plus some the same vector field or same vector at a displaced point, which we would say is V alpha of x. And we just do a Taylor series expansion. And so we're just using ordinary derivatives there. The problem is that this isn't really a useful way to talk about the change in a vector, or these ordinary derivatives aren't. This object isn't a tensor. Sorry, where was the question? Oh.
In what sense are we saying that these points are nearby? Are in the sense that the distance between them by the metric is small, in the sense that the coordinates are near each other?
That's an excellent question. In the sense that I'm using it here, I'm saying that the coordinate displacement is small, but I'm assuming that implicitly, well, no, I'm not. In writing this formula, all I'm assuming is that the coordinate displacement is a small quantity. Aaron.
So what we're going to end up getting is not a way to compare vectors at different points directly, but rather a derivative operator that can act on vector fields.
Yeah.
So to say that what this statement is really saying is that we're looking for a derivative operator which is local. It only depends on the vector. Like, no matter how small a neighborhood you draw around the vector field, the derivative of the vector field at that point only depends on what the vector field is like in that tiny neighborhood. That wasn't very clear, I think, if you did a different metric.
How about we go through the discussion? I'm sure what you want to do is build a covariant derivative. And that's what we're going to do. So this is a useful tool, since this isn't something that transforms nicely under coordinate transformations. Okay, so a simple example. Just to make that very explicit, is think about so if I'm just in Cartesian coordinates, think about just Minkowski space. This is one of the unit vectors along the x direction. But when I take that to polar coordinates, I end up with some very complicated expression here. Let's see if I can write it all down. Sine theta cos phi. Cos theta cos phi. So there's a rule on how you do coordinate transformations. You just follow that rule, and you end up with this representing the same vector. However, clearly, if I take v alpha dx alpha of this simple basis vector over here, I just get 0. But on the other hand, if I do, and I'll write hats, even though I don't mean orthonormal frame, but I mean a new set of coordinates, namely polar coordinates. If I take those derivatives over there, well, those are interesting functions, and so this isn't changing at all. Or this isn't 0. It's just some mess. But this then can't be, well, this isn't, the fact that I'm getting non-zero answers isn't saying that I have a complicated vector. The vector is actually very simple. But what that's a reflection of is the fact that in my new basis, I've expanded it in terms of a new set of basis vectors. And when I move from point to point, it's actually the basis vectors that are changing. And so these non-zero answers are a reflection of that fact. And so, well, that's just complaining, but the idea is that we'd like to build a new object or a new derivative operator that is going to have nice coordinate transformations. So if I end up with a statement like this, that the vector is constant or that the derivatives are vanishing, then that should apply in any coordinate system. And so the new derivative operator should take into account the fact that in certain bases, the basis vectors are moving around when you're comparing different points. So what we're looking for then is some object, some new derivative, and it acts on something like that. When I transform the coordinates, so it should just transform using the usual transformation rules. And in particular, then, if this vanishes, well, if it vanishes somewhere in one coordinate system, then it would vanish in any coordinate system.
Those hats are not orthonormal
here. No, that's just, OK. So that's, again, the lack of typesetting here. I just want to make sure that we know this is in a different coordinate system than that. And well, we can add that we'd also like it to be true that whatever object or set of rules we come up with, they reduce down to the standard set of rules when we go back to the familiar context of flat space with just Cartesian coordinates. But in fact, we've already studied or discussed a very similar problem when we were talking about geodesics. So or actually trajectories in general. What we wanted was to describe parameterized paths, and we had, well, an equation of motion in flat space. We have an equation of motion that looks like this. The second derivative with respect to our parameter is equal to zero, so that's a very boring equation. But it doesn't lift, didn't lift naively. The curved space. And it's precisely, again, because this combination of derivatives is not a four vector. But we know, well, we used an action principle, but we know what to how to extend that in order to produce a four vector. And so we what we had was the second derivative plus, and that's where the Christoffel symbol first appeared, beta mu and so this object wasn't a tensor. When I combine that thing that wasn't a tensor with this original thing that wasn't a tensor, the miracle that occurred was that that combination was a four vector. In particular, if I was thinking not about a geodesic but about some general time-like trajectory, that combination was what we gave us the four acceleration. Or I forget. So, well, okay. Some curly A alpha. Let's think a little bit about what's in that expression. When we were studying the geodesics and these became the proper time, then we actually, well, the notation we used was that this was actually a four, that first derivative was actually a four vector, and it was the four velocity. Here I've got the second derivative, but I want to take the derivative along a particular path. And so I can think of that as d by d lambda acting on the four velocity. Well, this four velocity depends where I am, i.e. it depends on the x's. And so if I use the chain rule, I can rewrite this as dx alpha d lambda . So this is just applying chain rule to re-express that. And so what it's saying is this is the ordinary derivative of the four velocity, but in the direction of the four velocity. Except I messed up the indices. OK, that's an alpha, beta, beta. So this was one of the components or one of the entries here, and I've just re-expressed it in terms of, well, the four velocity and ordinary derivatives acting on the four velocity. That means then that I can rewrite this expression as u beta d beta u alpha. And then I've got this connection piece, or this Christoffel symbol piece, alpha beta mu. And I can turn those first derivatives into u's. And so I can think of this as u contracted with some object. And it involves an ordinary derivative. And it involves a Christoffel symbol piece. The reason I paused so long there is that I think it's traditional to write this with the indices the other way around. But if you remember, the Christoffel symbol is symmetric, and so it doesn't really matter which way I write those indices right there. So we'll just write it the way it landed on the board. But what do we have then? Well, we have something here that's a four vector. We have something here that's a four vector. And that's contracted with another object. And so that other object must be a tensor. This has nice properties. This has nice properties. And so that must be reflected in the fact that the object that I'm writing there also has nice properties under coordinate transformations. And so this is, well, this is a useful definition then. It's one that we were, well, it emerges naturally from things we've been doing already. And I can write that, I'll call that the covariant derivative of u as having this ordinary derivative piece. And then this Christoffel symbol piece. So this is the piece that tells us just that the entries in my basis, those numbers are changing as I move around in the space-time. This is the piece that's telling us then that not only are the entries or the components changing, but the basis vectors are also changing. So this is something that's compensating for the fact that the basis, the coordinate basis, may be changing in our curved space time.
The alphas and betas on the right-hand side of that get switched from where they were in A alpha.
Well, okay. So I wasn't paying attention to what was written there. This is just a name of an index.
Yeah, but that's
so I've just renamed
them. We're not swapped, so now on the right.
Did I get this equation? No. What's wrong?
Well, like, look at the first term. You have partial with respect to alpha u beta. But over there, you have partial with respect to beta u alpha.
Right. So I've just renamed everywhere you see a beta there, I want to rename it alpha. I mean, it was just, yeah, so I have a lapse. I need to see what I was writing there. So I just wrote. So all that's happened is some of the indices got renamed.
That happens a lot in relativity.
That happens a lot, yes. And so, a simple exercise that you might do is we had an example of the just flat space, where we had the x basis vector turning into something complicated in polar coordinates. In ordinary Cartesian coordinates, this just vanishes because all of the derivatives of the metric components vanish, just ones and zeros. And so this was the only contribution, but it was zero as well. In polar coordinates, it should be that you get the same answer if this is a tensor. And so this should vanish. And so whatever variations you get here must be canceled by variations that you get from the Christoffel symbol. So you can check that with the example. I'm not going to do it right at the board. But this is then how it gives us a rule how to build a nice derivative of a covariant vector. We might want to extend that. What we've seen is there are lots of different kinds of objects. There are one forms or covectors, there are tensors with lots of indices. Some of the indices may be raised, some of the indices may be lowered. And so And you basically need to know one other thing, which is that, well, if I have a covariant, this operator acting on a scalar, so that's something without any indices, so it's just a function on our space-time, then, well, that's just the ordinary derivative, because this function is just a number everywhere, and it only depends on the labels. It doesn't depend on any bases or dual bases. And so the derivatives here are just the ordinary partial derivatives. But then we can use that to build up our rules for other kinds of tensors. So what about a covariant vector or a one form? What would I write there? Well, what I would like is that, I need one more, yet one more. So let's think about building a scalar. Not like all that. So if I have a vector in my one form, I take this contraction. That's just a function now. It's a scalar. It's an invariant object. I can act with this derivative. It's just the ordinary derivative acting on that collection of objects. So I just use the chain rule that we're used to. But now I'm going to invoke one other rule, which is that this chain rule or Leibniz rule that applies for, or that we know applies for ordinary derivatives, should also apply for our covariant derivative. So if I just carry through, then what I would like that to be, what did I call it? Beta alpha V alpha. So I want a chain rule to apply, basically, for this. But now, these are just the ordinary derivatives. I know what this is. I have to, or what I'm looking for is a rule for that. And so if I just plug that in, this is so this was our rule for the covariant derivative of a contravariant vector or a four vector. I can compare it to this formula, or alternatively, I subtract this from that. And what we have then, if I subtract the two equations, is so I took this expression, I subtract that expression. So this term just comes down. The ordinary derivatives of the t's cancel. Up to massaging the indices or relabeling the indices a little bit, this Christoffel term is just that Christoffel term. It's Christoffel contracted with a t and a v, so I've just rearranged it. And then this is the subtraction of the ordinary derivative. And I've assembled it together in a bracket in that way. Now, if this rule is supposed to apply for all v's and all t's, and it's equal to 0 on this side, then this covariant derivative must be just, well, the negative of that expression in brackets there. So so the main thing that's happened is I've picked up again a Christoffel term, except it appears now with a minus sign, and well, the indices have to be contracted up properly. But that's telling us then that here is another tensor, or that combination is another tensor object, and so that's a useful way to do the derivatives when the indices are downstairs. Yeah. Okay, and so we're done. Okay, I was going to quit anyway. There's one more formula you might write then to just generalize this expression. We've got scalars, we've got objects with one index, and so you can naturally follow the same bag of tricks to build up the general expression for a general tensor with an arbitrary number of indices.